Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now we shift our attention to some of the major stories coming out of the Middle East over the weekend. You may have read about the violent crackdown on protesters in Egypt, the resumption of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, or the upcoming inauguration of Iran's new president. I'm joined by Leila Hilal. She's the director of Middle East Task Force at the New America Foundation, and she can provide some context for these stories. Leila, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Let's start with the news out of Egypt over the weekend, where at least 72 people died in a crackdown on Islamist protests in Cairo on Saturday. Why was there such a violent response? Was it the military's attempt at damage control post-Morsi, and did it backfire?
The events followed the general of Sisi's comments. He's the head of the military forces. He called earlier in the week for people to come out and stage counter-protests to the expected pro-Morsi demonstrations. And he used incendiary language, saying we have to fight terrorists and terrorist elements in Egypt. And so that was read as a dangerous signal that would essentially tip off both security forces and civilians to conduct violence against the demonstrators. And in fact, that's what we saw. What we're seeing is perhaps not an unintended set of events, but a direct intervention whereby the military is trying to create the conditions where it can justify violence.
And did it work to discourage pro-Morsi protesters, or is it just spurring them on?
Well, they continue to go to the streets. They haven't changed their position. If anything, I think it is likely to generate more opposition and more protest. But I do think one could see that almost 3 years now, we've seen Egyptians in the streets and at mass levels, mass protests. And it could be possible that the Egyptian military, which is in charge now, is wanting to put an end to these street demonstrations because they are viewed as disruptive. Now, whether or not they will be able to do that, I think, is highly in doubt, because we have seen thousands to millions of Egyptians take to the street to voice their opinions on various positions and policies, statements by the different leaders that have been in power since the fall of Mubarak.
Yes, so, you mentioned mass protest. I mean, there was some celebration among Egyptians here in the U.S. after Morsi's ouster about 3 weeks ago. I wonder, in Egypt, what's your sense about where the masses are? I mean, who's being sort of sidelined as looking like they're stepping out of line after this violence?
Well, there was a very large campaign to hold the initial demonstrations on June 30th against Morsi's leadership. That campaign was led by an ostensible grassroots movement called Tamarod, and they collected 23 million signatures, which was supposed to reflect the will of the people, similar to, let's say, an election result reflecting the will of the people. And the majority of people in the streets calling for Morsi's ouster also accepted the military's coup. And so there are many people in Egypt that are saying that this set of events, the deposing of Morsi, is more or less a good direction. And what now needs to happen is that there needs to be a cabinet in place that can function well, that can reestablish Egypt's institutions, that can resolve the financial problems. And there are a lot of people that are willing to give the military the benefit of the doubt. And in this context, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the party that Morsi is representing, is now becoming, again, an opposition force, which is unlikely to be quiet or to return to its position of being a less politically visible party. So we have the prospect of a deeper polarization in Egypt.
Yeah, I mean, in the Times this morning, the piece about the Muslim Brotherhood had a number of people quoted as saying that we tried to do what they told us. We participated in politics, and this is where it got us. In this sense of like working within the system hasn't worked out for us. I mean, does this suggest real long-term instability if the Muslim Brotherhood is saying participating in elective politics is not working for us?
Well, I don't know to what degree the Muslim Brotherhood has such significant support that the majority of Egyptians will be objecting or not cooperating with an attempt to move the country forward. The Brotherhood obviously is a well-organized, well-established party in Egypt, but I don't think we can say that their support runs so deep as to a point of Egypt being coming to a grinding halt, more so than it is at this point in terms of the functioning of the state.
And one final question about Egypt. The U.S. response here, you mentioned the word coup. Does the decisive and violent action by the military over the weekend threaten the continuation of U.S. aid to Egypt?
Well, the U.S.-Egyptian relationship has been rocky for a long time, ever since 2011, when the military came to power, the fall of Mubarak. And there have been a number of incidents and moments where U.S. Congress in particular has raised red flags about the continued assistance, foreign assistance to Egypt. Egypt is one of the largest recipients of U.S. Foreign aid, and that aid comes mostly in the form of military assistance at $1.3 billion a year. And since the military coup of the past in the last month, or sorry, earlier in July, there has been a lot of heightened discussion about the relationship and the continuation of aid to Egypt. In particular, there is a law that says in the event that a military conducts a coup against a democratic leader, then the U.S. is required to suspend aid. The Obama administration has chosen not to take a position on this issue, not to define it as a coup, and therefore escape having to take action under that legal provision. But many congressional representatives are raising the prospect of the need to reconsider the high level of aid that continues to go to Egypt. And I think you will see that debate continue to play out.
Well, let's move on to more potentially optimistic news. Negotiators from Israel and the Palestinian Authority will resume peace talks tonight in Washington, picking up where they left off in 2010. Who's coming to the table and what's the goal this round?
Well, tonight, over the iftar breaking of the Ramadan fast, you will see Justice Minister Tiffany Livni and Chief Negotiator Saab Erekat sit down together with Secretary Kerry to begin discussions about discussions. There are a lot of questions that are left unanswered in terms of the terms of reference of the negotiations. The Palestinians want the 1967 green line between Israel and the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They want that line to be the basis of talks. Secretary Kerry has indicated verbally that or orally that this is acceptable, but they have not received it in writing. Palestinians also want to see an end to settlement activity, and Netanyahu's government has not made such commitment. Netanyahu's made vague statements saying that the settlement activity will slow down. But so you still have very major sticking points that the Palestinians will have to pay close attention to moving forward. So what we can expect from these initial talks tonight hopefully will be further clarification of what the negotiations will be about going forward.
So you mentioned Secretary of State John Kerry. He's been working for months to get these talks going. Should we see this as an achievement for the new Secretary of State, or is this a photo op?
I think you could say it's definitely an achievement for him, and one that he fought hard to gain, because, as I said, the Palestinians haven't achieved their basic conditions that they've been sticking to since the talks broke down in 2010, which is a freeze on settlements and the commitment that the 1967 line is the basis of a negotiation for a two-state solution. So Secretary Kerry can definitely say that this is an achievement, but whether or not it can succeed and what that success looks like in the end, I think, are two big questions that he will have to grapple with. But recent news that he's appointing Martin Indyk to be the peace envoy for these talks indicates that, in fact, there is a major investment underway.
Why do you say that?
Well, because I think the appointing of a peace envoy means that they intend to have some longevity to this process. Martin Indyk is a seasoned diplomat. He's been engaged in the Israel-Palestinian domain for quite a long time. He holds a great deal of respect on the Israeli side and amongst Palestinians. So I think that we will see this process continue. I also think the two people that are going to be meeting tonight, Tiffany Livni and Saab Erekat, are both individuals that are committed to a negotiation process. And so I think that there is a general genuine level of commitment to these talks, but I think that the barriers to a successful outcome that would be a settlement, a final settlement of the conflict, I think, are most likely too high to get over at this point in time. Mm.
So we'll start with this meeting about meeting process tonight. Let's turn now to Syria. It was reported this weekend that Ahmad al-Jarba, the head of the main Syrian opposition group, has agreed to meet with President Bashar al-Assad in Geneva for a peace conference. Is Assad on board with this?
The Syrian Bashar al-Assad, who's the sitting president, has said that he would send a delegation to Geneva. That has been his position for a while. But the issue is whether or not the sponsors of a round of talks in Geneva would actually call the parties to Geneva to have talks. Because there's a large question mark as to whether or not the conditions are ripe for a positive outcome. there is an expectation amongst everyone that, let's say, quite similar to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, should the Syrian regime and the opposition sit down together, it would take quite a long time for them to get to any final agreement. But you don't want to get these actors in the room and have it break down immediately, especially since it would be the first attempt for direct talks.
So the question of timing, when is the right time to have this peace conference? But as far as who would come and who would be negotiating, what authority does Ahmad al-Jarba actually have? He only represents part of the many opposition groups, right?
Jarba is head of the Syrian Opposition Coalition, which is the main opposition body that's been recognized by more than 100 states. The Arab League has recognized it as the representative of Syria in the Arab League. So it has the endorsement of the majority of states, European states, the U.S., and the Gulf and Arab states that would be backing this political process. Russia, a major player here, does not look at the opposition as being, or the Syrian coalition as being the sole legitimate representative of the Syrian people, and so they've raised the question of who negotiates as being an important one for convening the process. There are a number of armed groups on the ground in Syria, which obviously makes it difficult for anyone to say that they have control on the ground and can deliver on a result. But I think the Syrians may be pressured to bring more groups to the table with them to have a broader coalition than just the main opposition force. But that remains to be seen.
So in both Israeli-Palestinian talks and this Syrian peace conference that is yet to be scheduled, been talking more about incremental processes. But to finish, what about Iran and the inauguration preparations this week for the new president? His election was hailed as a good sign for Iran since he's a cleric, but he's also a moderate. How big a shift is this going to be in Iran?
Well, one interesting additional point is that the president-elect Rouhani is also said to be close to the Ayatollah Khomeini, who is known to control, to be the most powerful figure in Iran, the one who calls the shots. And so that is an additional point to factor in when we say that this could be a positive moment for engaging Iran and for seeing some progress in the nuclear talks and potentially on Syria, as Iran is a major backer of the Assad regime. We have to wait and see, though, because the balance of power is with the Ayatollah, and it remains to be seen whether Rouhani can have an influence that will impact Iran's overall policy. But there are many positive signs that would suggest that policymakers should see this as an opportunity and hopefully reach out to the extent possible to see what's possible.
Okay, well, so many things to keep watch on. Leila Hilal is director of the Middle East Task Force at the New America Foundation. Leila, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be checking back with you soon, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we're going to look at the pros and cons of rent regulation in New York. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer.